Welcome to the Share Vancouver podcast, a safe space for BIPOC, LGBTQ plus individuals and allies. We are two queer South Asian women who are on a mission to highlight and celebrate queer folks and allies in our community.
Our intention is to normalize, tear down societal norms, and provide representation. We hope to build community by sharing our stories and experiences with everyone. So I'm your host, Sharon.
And I'm your host, Neri.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Share Vancouver podcast, season three. Neri.
Yes,
I'm here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy Lordy, happy birthday, Rahat.
Yeah.
All of the above.
All of the above. Today, we're kicking off the new year with a special guest who has made it her life mission to take up space. Rahat Saini is an actor, storyteller, and comedian. Her TikTok video about coming out as bisexual to Punjabi parents went viral and has over 1.4 million views. As a Punjabi bisexual woman in her acting field, she is making herself visible and taking up space to help empower other brown women to do just that. So without further ado, let's welcome Rahat here with us.
Hello, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Hello. Welcome. Excited.
We love your shirt today. Tell us about that.
Thank you so much. This shirt arrived in the mail only like 3 days ago. So it felt like a sign that I had to wear it here today. Yes. Felt very aligned with what we're talking about. And also very aligned with who I am and what I feel when it comes to the world and taking up space. I think it's actually pretty related.
It's very on point.
Yeah, the shirt is from a brand called Change. So if anyone's interested in copping one, it's a great brand. All their stuff is very mindfully sourced and organic cotton and this, that, responsible practices and their supply chain and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's expensive, but it's good, great quality, and I love the message.
I love it, too.
And it says for all the listeners out there that aren't watching us on YouTube, it says women don't owe you shit.
Women don't owe you shit. You can take that home and say it to everyone you know. I think it's an important message and probably really important for brown women and their people in their lives to hear.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
And that's exactly the energy we're trying to bring for 2024.
100%.
So you nailed it today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We would love to start off by knowing more about yourself. And we learned reading up on you that you grew up in India. So can you tell us about your childhood growing up in India and how that was for when you moved to Canada in your teens?
Yeah, I had an interesting backstory, I guess. My parents had already immigrated to Canada. They lived here, had been living here for like 20 years. They met here, got married here, had my older sister, then me, and then moved to India when I was 3 months old, an infant. The old reverse immigration. It's less popular than the original. But my parents moved there, and I grew up in India, in Chandigarh, for 13 years of my life. And although we had relatives here in Canada, we would come back and forth quite a bit. And so I was familiar enough with Canada, with the culture, with, of course, the languages. I say plural, just English. I was not familiar with French. And it was very much a part of my life, mm-hmm. being part Canadian or coming to Canada. But that didn't change the fact that when we moved here eventually in 2011, when I was 13, that it was a bit of a shock, a cultural shock, because although I lived in India surrounded by brown people, of course, mm-hmm. and then moved to Surrey, also largely surrounded by brown people, there was a distinct difference in the kind of community and interconnectedness, tolerance, I guess, that exists. And I think that's largely shaped by the fact that I grew up in a city in India where I was surrounded by a lot of different types of people, and my parents kind of instilled that type of acceptance and understanding in us that people are different, and that's good. Difference is good. I find sometimes in Surrey the experience can be a bit different than that, and sometimes communities, for understandable reasons, can be quite tight-knit and a bit less accepting of different people. So it was a bit shocking. Even though there was lots of people that looked like me, I found culturally we were quite different. Mm-hmm. And eventually, after trying to make friends with brown people, which I did for a bit, I found my lasting home in the theater. And that's a pretty normal story for folks who feel like outsiders, whether that's queer folks or, you know, sometimes people of color as well, an overlap of both in my case, as well as people of all other sort of marginalized identities, I think, tend to find themselves a home in some sort of community. And theater tends to be a pretty significant sort of homing beacon for weirdos and loners. Just kidding. We love it there.
I'm like, dude, I was a part of improv, trick theater. I guess I'm one of them, but yeah.
Yeah, I am too.
Yeah, no, I hear you when you say that, though, because it's like where you can like really let yourself out. And
absolutely.
Yeah, there's like a lot of character development as well within that. And you just kind of can do you and be you and not worry.
And connect with people on something deeper than just what your skin color is or what your culture is or whatnot. You know, I feel like there's greater shared goals that tend to bring people together, which is nice.
Yeah. It takes way more courage also in high school. Did you join in high school?
I actually started acting when I was like 10 years old. I've been on a stage as many times as I can possibly manage to my entire life.
Awesome. So you started in India then?
Yeah, I started singing when I was like a year old. My mom often tells a story of how she was changing my diaper and I could hardly speak. Like I was a year and a half old and she takes me to the bathroom and I'm singing "Oh Oh Jaane Jaane" like from the Salman Khan movie. And she's like, what the hell is this child I'm holding? And I could hardly string together a sentence, but I was singing like the full song to the best of my ability as a toddler. Wow. And my mom, I think, knew that this child is doing something. We don't know what. And so I grew up singing a lot. And it was around the age of 10 that I started acting. But definitely I took it seriously more and considered it more of a life journey and a career path of sorts by the time I got to high school. But I think at that point I was still quite afraid of the grand, overwhelming lack of possibilities when it comes to being an actor, especially. The chances, I guess, seem so slim, and they are. Like, I'm not going to lie about that. So I was quite afraid of actually accepting my dream as my own and claiming that I wanted to be an actor. By the end of high school, I told everyone, including my mom and myself, that I was going to go study theater so that I could be a drama teacher. Which is a lie many people tell.
Yeah.
And in my case, I don't think it was fully a lie. I do want to teach. I think I will one day. But I don't think it's through the specific structure of being like a high school drama teacher.
Yeah.
Which some of my friends have gone on to do. And I think it's a really, really important thing.
For sure.
A lot of drama teachers have shaped lives. They've saved lives.
I fully agree, yeah.
And I think that's really, really important. But I don't think it's what I want to do quite yet, or maybe ever, in that specific format. I think teaching is so valuable that I don't want to diminish its value by claiming it as my backup plan.
Yeah, girl, you're talking to a teacher here.
Yeah.
Be careful.
Yeah, exactly. No, I would never. I would never be like, no, if I can't fucking do this, then I'll just, like, teach or whatever. It's just not. It's just, I think it's so valuable what teachers do that you have to put your heart and soul into it. But, yeah, so I'm grateful enough that I went on to study theater in university, which is where I changed gears and really accepted that it's what I want to do.
Yeah, and how was that, like picking, like even telling your parents, like, hey, I want to take art. Well, I know we all know Indian culture is like doctor, lawyer, engineer. And then anything else outside of that, you're like, meh.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
But why?
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. My mom was telling the story recently of how someone she knows went on to, in his, like, adulthood, be an Olympian. This is one of my uncles. He played hockey in the Olympics. And when they were looking for like a rishta for him, they're like having conversations and literally somebody said ke acha hockey da khelda ya par munda karda ki ya, you know, like, okay, so he plays hockey or whatever, but what does he
what
do
does he really
and
do?
It's like, this man was an Olympian, like so I hear you. I think that's a very normal mindset in our community, and I do think it comes from a place of care, because our parents and elders and even sometimes contemporaries have lived this life of needing to survive. Mm-hmm. And I understand that it comes from a place of concern, of not believing that an artistic or in otherwise alternative career could lead to security and financial freedom at some point. And I can't even lie and say that's not true. I think it can be true, very much so. In my case, I am blessed with really incredible parents who, in their own lives, I think, had dreams that were in some ways dismissed or diminished by their own families or parents or, you know, cultural duties. Yeah. And I know they went on to both of them went on to have careers that they hadn't originally envisioned for themselves. And that's very normal. I feel like most of our parents fit into that category. Yeah. And in my case, my mom actually used to act when she was in college. And she still does, actually, after some encouragement. She took a break of her from her hiatus and is now back to performing, which is awesome.
Yeah. So she's performing as well now?
Yeah, my mom's an actor. She sings as well, beautifully, and is a Punjabi singer. If you guys need someone to perform at your family event, I have a hookup. Yeah.
You and your mom.
Me and my mom. Well, mostly my mom, but I'll show up. I'll MC your event. But yeah, when I told my parents that I wanted to become an actor, putting it on the table, this is what I want to do. I know I said I'll be a teacher, but I lied. And I had to have that conversation.
Yeah.
Because I think I told them I would do a double major or something. And then by like second year, it was obvious I was not doing a double major. Should have started on that if I was going to do it. And they accepted it. They were cautious. They were concerned. Mm-hmm. They were curious as to how I'm going to build a whole life on this dream. But they were also encouraging, and they showed me that they believed in my ability. They said, well, if this is what you want to do, you have to understand how challenging this is, how hard you're going to have to work, how many obstacles are going to be in your path. And I say this now, too, to anybody who wants to be an actor or anything that's in an artistic field. I think it's a really hard journey because the world does not set you up to fail as often as you need to when you're an artist. And that's necessary for growth. But our parents don't want us to fail. And I think that's hard for them, too.
Yeah, because, you know, all of our parents like that came here as immigrants, as we all are immigrants in general, white peoples, too. They came here, they struggled, right? They had to take what they could get for a job with racism and such coming here, maybe whenever it was, could be from the 50s, 60s, 70s. Our 80s. So yeah, when we're saying we want to pick like acting, like my mom actually had encouraged me after high school to go, oh, if you want to take drama for, you know, your further education, like you should do your passion, what you're passionate about.
Aww.
And then my dad's like, no. Nope.
Like, okay. Dr. Bankurie.
Go do this. Do that. So I did. And that's fine, right? But I love doing watching theater and such.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's always interesting to see where our parents stand in that. And that's so encouraging to hear that. But I also think that it's changed so much within the art scene in Vancouver for BIPOC folk to really get out there and get highlighted. And people getting involved in general and seeing your success as well has been so, so amazing. You know what I mean?
Thank
so nice
you.
To see.
It is really special. I won't lie. In my relatively short career so far, I have had both incredibly difficult, racist, fatphobic, misogynistic incidences and situations, superiors, professors, all sorts of stuff that can be really discouraging, that can make you feel really limited. I have had that. I've also had excellent people to work with, brilliant directors and incredibly supportive cast members and friends and connections, people who showed me that my inherent value as a performer is way greater than any particular role. And I think despite everything difficult that I've had to deal with so far, and I'm sure it's not done, I'm sure there's harder things coming too. But as much as I've had to deal with, I feel really grateful knowing that there has never been a moment in time, in history, where I could have come at a better time to be me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is a gift, you know? There is not a time in human history where I would have had a better chance doing what I do. And that instills a type of confidence in me, knowing that not only are there more things coming that we haven't even thought about, things that are going to get made, but that I have a shot to be in those things, to write those things, to produce those things. That makes me so excited, and it helps deal with all the difficult stuff, which comes up from time to time, and that I think a lot of us, in our own ways, carry with us.
Mm-hmm. I feel like post-pandemic, a lot of changes has happened. Like, I am a teacher in schools. Always chatting with Neri, like, it's totally different. Like, we're having more diversity books. Like, we're reading about, like, I teach kindergarten, so kids are learning, like, oh, they can be whatever they want when they grow up. Like, an engineer, like, a girl can be an engineer, mm-hmm. and, like, boys can be, you know, different roles. Like, mm-hmm. these sort of, like, narratives weren't there, I feel like, pre-pandemic as a teacher. Like, it's really changing. And I think now, like, with the push for BIPOC artists, BIPOC creatives, storytellers to come forth, they're making that space. They were always there, but now the space is
100%
not being allowed, but we're almost taking it, like you said, take up space. It's like we are kind of woken up like, hey, this is not okay. Like, we should also, you know, use our voice, follow our passions. And I think because we're grateful to our parents who've had that struggle, like, our generation is able to follow our dreams.
Totally.
And I think, like, joining Shiravan, like, seeing Rashi, Charlie, or behind the scenes, like, we've met so many creatives who follow their passion, and they're like, wow, like, how do you do it?
And it takes a lot of courage.
It does.
Like, it really does. And I say that to the creative people in the room and to everyone listening. It takes a lot of courage to choose to do what you love. In a world that makes you feel like that is an ill-advised, very bad decision.
Yes.
And of course those things are furthered by, you know, the marginalized identities who are trying to simply make it in a world that doesn't feel like it's made for them. And it makes you that much more likely to pick a safe option. And I support that. I think it's understandable to want a safe option.
Yeah,
I think you do yourself a great disservice by not allowing yourself the chance to try. And I think that kind of catches up to you in your human life. And I hope that for people listening, even if it's not like a massive professional life change in any way, but just an opportunity to try something that your heart tells you you want to do. Like, for my mom in her 60s to be in rooms auditioning for commercials or in a short film that went on to win awards and, you know, like, various things that she does, whether it's performing at people's functions, Ronka events, name drop. She would appreciate that. I think it's important to feed the soul as much as we feed our bellies and feed our, you know, faces. I don't know.
Totally. Like, I mean, that's like, I feel like Sharon and I, this is like our passion project that like we really want to embrace and bring limelight to the community, right? As well as with allies as well. Mm-hmm. And it's passion. It's, yeah, it's a huge passion project for us. So people that can go outside of that and make a career out of that, woo! Like, kudos and big ups to y'all. You know
Thank
what I mean?
You.
Like, it's amazing. And we need to highlight those folks too in the industry and show that, yes, you can do this full time. And look at the people that we've been able to bring pull up, right? And so it's awesome. We've had some great artists on here.
Yes, I've been browsing through. I'm so grateful that I get to be here and be highlighted by you folks. I feel so inspired when I see other brown artists, and not just specifically brown, but marginalized folks of all identities, taking up space and being not just successful, but putting themselves out there in any way, shape, or form, whether they achieve success or not, because I think that can be a bit arbitrary, and people can have different meanings for that word. But I think it means so much to see people trying, to see people taking a chance. And even if it means you fall down, I think it's important to learn how to get up.
Oh, for sure.
And you can only do that if you fall. You can't do it if you stay standing and still.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important thing that I hope people take away.
Mm-hmm. You've been on the rise. Like, Neri and I got to learn about you other than your TikTok video, but we also got to see you in, like, articles about your play that you were in for Unexpecting. And I remember reading the article in Surrey. I think it was, like, Vancouver or, like, Surrey. And I was like, oh, my God, it was, like, a brown woman, like, bisexual woman wants to be out there and is in this play. And we're like, oh, my God, we got to go watch this. So can you tell us about Unexpecting and ZZ Theater and your whole experience with that play? Because that was incredible.
Absolutely. Thank you guys again for coming to see the show and to give it giving it a shout out. I think having your support there, it meant so much to me. And any brown folks, especially, that came to see that show, when I saw those faces in the audience, it filled my heart with so much joy. I had a wonderful experience working with ZZ Theater. I became acquainted with them when I saw Men Express Their Feelings, which was another one of their productions the year before. And I worked with them as a community outreach director. And it was my job to get people in to see the show. And I felt so passionate about it once I read the script, because I knew how important it is to see queer brown representation. I had basically never seen queer brown representation.
Especially like live in the
person. Yeah. In our city.
Yes.
And with folks, like the story is about the people in our city as well. And that's so rare in and of itself. Yeah. But to see queer brown folks, I think sometimes, and I said this maybe in the article that you read as well, but I think sometimes we see representation in these little boxes that are separate from each other. And we see queerness in its own little box, and we see people of color in their own little boxes. And it's like the folks in charge want to tick off separate little boxes.
Yeah.
And it negates the reality, which is that we are all complex, nuanced individuals who don't fit into boxes and who have overlaps in our identities. I, yes, am bisexual. I'm also a brown woman. I also, for a lot of my life, identified as a fat woman. That colors my experience. I have grown up in a different country. I, you know, like all these different facets of my life influence how I live it. And I think seeing a person on stage who carries all of that and more in their own unique way is so meaningful.
Yeah.
And I think theater is really powerful, especially because when you're in a room with someone and you're witnessing their story, you're seeing them live out their truth, if it's good theater, hopefully, it touches you in a different way.
Yeah.
You can't ignore the visceral reaction your body has to someone else's tears or their pain or their laughter when it's happening in the same room as you. It's a human reaction. It's empathy. And putting brown folks in decidedly queer roles, especially queer brown folks, putting them in that spot and giving them that opportunity to live out that truth in one way or another, it can touch so many people and make them feel seen in a way that they haven't before. And I felt that way sitting in the audience for Men Express Their Feelings. And I am not a young queer teenage boy, which was the subject of the story. Yet, it didn't matter because I don't think representation is as cut and dry as some people want it to be. It's not boxes. It's about truth. It's about connection. It's about humanity. And to see a young brown teenage boy have the struggle of telling his parent, you know, that he's queer and how that's affecting his life or getting him bullied or whatever it may be, to have that interaction happen on stage in front of people was meaningful. Yeah. It touched me.
Big time, yeah.
And
we were there as well.
Yeah, we got to watch that as well.
And it was
amazing,
brilliant.
Yeah.
And so I felt so excited about that company. I knew I wanted to work with them however I could, whenever I could. And I was blessed enough that Cameron approached me with an audition for Unexpecting less than a year later.
Wow.
And once I read for the role, I felt so connected to it. I was so excited about it, and I was so grateful that they cast me in it. And the whole process was fantastic. Unlike the cast of Men Express Their Feelings, which was four men, Unexpecting was a cast of four women. And it was amazing to work with this group of actors, most of whom had much more experience than I did in the industry in general, especially in theater, in being in professional productions. I look up to them. And it was so refreshing and freeing to be a part of a show where I was living out a version of my life that some people would rather forget I could even have.
Yep.
As a bisexual woman, especially, who currently is partnered with a man, there's often a feeling of, well, if you're with a dude, like, you're with a dude, like, you're basically straight. And that's not true. And so to be on stage as a queer woman, partnered with a woman, living out a version of my life where that's very much could be a reality for me. And, you know, to deal with the challenges that come with, okay, so now we want to start a family. And what does that look like? And how does adoption actually go? And what are the struggles of, you know, being a queer couple, trying to adopt a baby and the financial, emotional turmoil you deal with? It was all very, very
real, very real, and very,
I hope, educational to the audience who can sometimes be a bit flippant about topics like adoption. I think we tend to think of adoption as like, well, you can just adopt as like a really easy solution, which can be really challenging for people to actually do. And that's regardless if you're straight or not. But I think especially for people who don't have an option to biologically procreate, and that's one of their few options to have a child if they want to be a parent, I think to deal with the reality of that is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, we both obviously were at that play. I mean, I cried through it.
We were
like,
tearing up.
Yeah, we were both through it. And then Sharon at the end was like, were you crying? I was like, yeah.
I was crying too.
Do you want my Kleenex?
Yeah, we should have given like a tear warning.
It was so cool though that, like, you know, for the listeners, that you were the main, like one of the main roles. It's not like you were this, like the brown, you know, usually the brown folks, like the side role, like you didn't come in for like 5 minutes. Like you were in the entire play. Mm-hmm. You were the main person who's in a queer relationship. And girl, you made out with the person on stage.
I sure did.
Sharon's still like always in shock therapy when she sees anybody.
When I see a brown person like kissing. Live, I'm like, oh, where's the parents?
What's happening? Like, oy, mommy no para? Yeah,
okay. I was like, Sharon, it's normal. I'm like,
no, not that it's normal. I'm like amazed. I'm like, wow, you go, girl. Oh, we need her on the podcast, and here we are.
No, I always laugh about that because my parents came to that show.
Yeah,
like, my parents saw me make out with a woman during that show.
Yeah.
And I asked. I mean, I had given them a warning. I was like, guys. Just letting you know, I already bought your tickets. So you can't back out.
Yeah. Like, Mike, hello.
You're coming to the show. Also, I'm making out with a woman, like, right
see,
away.
You do have to give and, these.
Well, the thing is, I just didn't want them to be like, what? Because when my partner came to see the show, he knew, but he had, like, known for a while, so he kind of forgot. Because he was helping me read lines and stuff constantly. So he knows the show like the back of his hand. And then he saw me, like, make out with a woman. And I know the first time he saw the show, it, like, threw him out just a little bit. It's just, like, a bit of a, like, a cognitive dissonance of, like, that's my girlfriend, I think, but that's not my girlfriend. And I get it. Like, I think dating an actor is weird for that reason.
Yeah.
But he had to see it again. And he's like, second time, I was just paying attention to the story. I forgot it was you. I'm like, oh, thank God. I did my job right. But I had to give my parents a bit of a warning, too, for the same reason. I'm like, I just don't want it to throw you out completely. Mm-hmm. I want you to be able to see the show and not be, like, worried. And when I asked them by the end, they didn't care. They had so many good things to say about the show that they forgot that the show started with me, like, kissing my lovely scene partner Jessica for a long time. Mm-hmm. An appropriate time because we're married in the show.
Yeah.
but it was not what they walked away thinking about.
Love it.
Yeah, of course.
And that's
a
win.
And that's what that's what we need to do is break those barriers down, right? And
like, absolutely.
I love that your parents were there and they came out and supported. I feel like we watched another play where, like, I think it's changing now. Like, even in, like, cinema or, like, Indian films, like, they're actually. Remember back in the days, Bollywood, the chimney
the full charne.
The
two flowers.
A shadow would come, flowers would make out, but now it's changing, you know, like in every area. So it's really cool to see. Of course, live is a whole nother level.
Yes.
And with your parents there. So
yes.
We've been chatting with a lot of people who have created, like, more films like that, and their parents are in the audience. It's cool to hear that side too, right? Because we obviously are more used to it. That generation is still getting used to their own child.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even, like, with straight relationships, hetero relationships, it's still so taboo or abnormal 100%. To express affection.
Yeah.
And I think what makes it even harder when it comes to queerness for parents and such, for older folks, is I think there's this weird thing that happens that with straight couples, like, they can like each other, and love can be a lot more than just sex.
Mm-hmm.
Like, love and romance and passion and feelings can be just, like, so much bigger and poetic and beautiful. But when it comes to queer people, it's like, oh, it's all about who wants to have sex with who and who wants to put what in where. Like, and it's like, why aren't queer people allowed the same kind of freedom to like or have a crush or, you know, fall in love and have a romance and have it be innocent and beautiful and also sexual and romantic? But it doesn't always have to be that. And I think when it comes to portrayals of queerness in stories, especially, it helps mesh that divide. Yes. Of, you know, queer stories, whether about love or pain or loss or whatever, but hopefully about love, because we have a lot of queer stories about pain.
Yeah.
But those stories are just as deserving of the space to be more and to be nuanced and complicated and beautiful than just being about who wants to put it in where. I don't think that's as important. I don't think that's anyone's business, for one. but I also don't think it's as important as the greater nuances of stories.
Mm. Yeah, I know we have a friend that we've also had on who's an actor that has spoken about that, how the gay roles that, like, you know, they're being put forward, like, and, you know, they made it very clear, like, I'm not coming out as being this, you know, flamboyant gay guy.
Stereotypical
BS portrayals. Right? And so I was like, that's so great when I heard that story. I was like, that's amazing. And you know what? Good for you standing up for yourself and also bringing your real role and what you want to bring to the screen instead of them saying, no, we're going to make you do this and that. Totally. I was like, oh my God, bless your soul.
Yes. That takes a lot of courage.
That does. It takes a lot of courage. And I'm glad that they did that. You know,
absolutely.
And so we got to keep doing that.
I'm grateful they're in a place where they can demand that and it can be heard. I sure hope that that continues to happen. Because it is true. I think a lot of the industry, especially when it's folks who aren't from a community writing roles for that community, it can be quite limiting in its portrayal because they don't know the reality and they're, again, trying to tick a box.
Yeah.
More so than tell a real story about a real person. And so I'm really grateful for artists like that who speak up and demand that they do a better job at their jobs, because I don't think that ticking a box for meaningless representation is nearly as important as telling a real story about real people having real shit going on in their lives.
That's what I want to see more of, is just real shit. Like the play that you did, that was real stuff. People can resonate with that and like really feel attached and, you know, get emotional about it. The other play as well, why am I forgetting the name of it?
Men
Express Feelings. You know, real stuff. Like, I'd love to see more of that. Because I know now in every show, even in Hollywood, like, it's, there's always a queer character now. There's always BIPOC folk in there. But it's like, are they the real proper stories? I'm sure it's about a 50-50%, you know. So
I think
they
it's really changing, though.
It is.
Like, I mean, I don't really watch a lot of shows, but my sister, like, always, like, oh, yeah, like, they're very openly talking, like, queer identities, trans identities on shows now, which I feel like you wouldn't have seen, like, three, four years ago.
Yeah. It was a lot less. And I do think it's changing. I hope it continues to change and meaningfully so. Not just in empty ways, but for it to be lasting. Not a checklist, not boxes, but for it to be lasting, meaningful change. I think the folks behind the screen, the folks writing the stories have to change as well. And I do think that's happening. I want to give credit to all the incredible BIPOC, queer, marginalized writers out there who are, you know, fighting tooth and nail to tell better stories. And I hope that continues to happen. Even with one of my most recent projects that came out this summer, which is called Make Me a Match. It's a Hallmark movie, which Hallmark has a very documented history of being quite limited in the kind of stories they used to tell. And that started to change, too, in the last few years only, really. But in the last, like, 3-4 years, they've started to make a really significant shift towards telling a different kind of story. And that's coming down the wire into opportunities for people like me. And hopefully for a lot more folks too. And the person who wrote Make Me a Match is Nikhil Jairam, who is a brown man. And you know, you can tell. And even if the story's gone through some iterations to fit into the Hallmark structure, at the core of it, it's still about brown people from the perspective of a brown person. And I think that shows.
But actually, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And we'll be back in a second.
You're listening to the Share Vancouver podcast with Sharon and Neri. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break. Share Vancouver is a registered charity for LGBTQ2S+ South Asians, their friends, and families in Metro Vancouver, BC. Share Vancouver aims to reduce the alienation and discrimination of people experiencing sexuality, gender, and coming out issues through a variety of services. Learn more by visiting sharevancouver.com today.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. We got Rahith back up in the mix here after a little quick break. So, sorry, we're going to let you carry on. We're chit-chatting about.
We're talking about Make Me a Match. Is that what we're doing?
We were segueing into that. And what that experience was, and you're just saying how, like, Hallmark has changed so much so in bringing these voices and folks, people of color, marginalized folks into their movies, because it was very white.
It was.
It was very white for a long time.
To the point where when I first started working in the film and TV industry, which wasn't that long ago, I graduated university with my BFA in 2020, and pretty soon after came back home to Surrey and started working towards film and TV auditions and roles, but there's a pretty big barrier of access. You need an agent and this, that. So all of that time while I was taking classes, starting auditions, I had such a limiting belief in my head to the point where I said it out loud in my acting class that, oh, like Hallmark's never going to hire me. And my friends in class remembered that. And when I then booked more than one role in more than one Hallmark project down the line, would remind me that I said that. And I was like, oh, I did say that, didn't I? And I think it was based in old Hallmark. It was based in what we all recognize as like the Hallmark movies that we've seen growing up or whatever. And I think it's a really great sign that something that has been in all of our memories sort of solidified as this always telling stories about white people company has changed, you know? And I think that's a good sign for other production companies. And whether it's for reasons that have to do with profit or not, I think there is a undeniable shift that's happened in the kind of stories that people want to see as well. And I think it's only going to get more and more specific and hopefully truthful with time. Because, yeah, sometimes you have to dip your toes into the little kitty culture pool. But with time, I think that can become deepened, you know, for folks that have like never had a brown neighbor or never met anyone who's had an arranged marriage. Having a story told in this Hallmark movie fashion, a story that focuses on, you know, matchmaking in the Indian way and what that process might look like, even if it's through a Hallmark lens, I still think it introduces people that might otherwise have zero experience with that whole web of culture to it in a way that's accessible and, you know, not so challenging, not so foreign. And that if that can affect someone in Midwest America to view their brown neighbor as more human. As so someone who's just like them. You know, I think that can be really powerful. I think these stories, even if sometimes from a critical, cynical lens, we can view them as something else, I think if they can humanize folks who are not like us, that can be extremely powerful. And I think that's what stories do.
So we watched it last night. It
was okay, great.
Yes, I loved it. I was telling Diri, I was like, oh my God, it's super cheesy.
Very much
but
so.
I understand from where you're coming from where Hallmark was to being very white. Of course, the movie was very traditional, like, oh, Indian chai,
the mother
speaking with an accent, and the son is la, la, la. But I did think it did do a good job for exposing the Indian culture to people who may not know about Indian matchmaking. And I thought it was so funny because, like, you know, the whole Indian matchmaking show.
Of course. I do think the success of the Netflix series Indian Matchmaking probably in some way inspired this film into happening. Because, of course, that show got like millions and millions of views on Netflix. And, of course, that's going to inspire somebody to be like, okay, so there's a market for this.
100%.
People are interested in the matchmaking process that a lot of Indian people participate in. And I can understand why I would make a movie about it. It's fascinating. 100%. 100%. it's freaking fascinating. And so many of us have had that experience in our own families of that happening, whether it's directly us or not.
Yeah, and like if you think about it too, like, you know, growing up, we never really saw brown people on TV, right? And so now that there's a huge population of brown people worldwide, any country, there are brown people. There's so many people everywhere, right?
Everywhere.
So, you know what, when you do see it on TV or wherever, streaming networks and such, online, you want to watch it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you're like, oh my God, you got me.
Exactly.
I'm in. Sold.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah. So, I mean, they're marketing it the right way. In that sense, so
they are. And I feel so grateful that this production, as far as I can see, they tried to do things as intelligently as they could to support the cultural content of the film with some real people behind it. So they had a cultural consultant on set Who was there, like, is a brown woman and was there to, you know, kind of oversee the parts where we're talking about cultural stuff, so that the director, who is not brown, her name is Heather, and Heather Hawthorne Doyle, and she was very interested in making sure that everything is still being observed by the cultural consultant and that she's taking the time to not just, like, sweep over any of that stuff. And and I think that kind of care is necessary. I've been on set for other things where they've had cultural content kind of intermixed with the story, and there's no one.
Yeah, that's so true.
On set.
I'm so glad to hear that, because I've heard people, I have some friends that are in the film industry, and they overlook that stuff or they don't care for it. So
and
that's
it shows.
So nice to hear.
It showed in the movie, though, 100%. Because it shows, like, obviously context of the movie. It's like, oh, white girl who's trying to, you know, get a matchmaking Indian woman to come and share her techniques of, like, the old Indian matchmaking traditions, which is family is really important. They don't really care about all your successes. As we know, as a woman, you can freaking be president, but they're like, but are you married?
Can you cook?
can you have children? So it kind of, like, touched on those, like, important things.
Totally.
In, like, a funny, cheesy way, but I feel like it does help, like, for, like, interracial marriages, for people who are not used to the Indian tradition. Like, you're not just marrying the person, you are marrying the family.
Whole family.
The whole family is going to be involved in your life.
They'll be in your business.
I mean, I did send it to my partner last night. I was like, girl, watch this. So
get ready.
You understand where we're going, what the 100%. Future looks like.
And no, it's so true. Like, I think having that extra set of eyes and attention behind the scenes makes a huge difference. Having been on sets where they don't have that or haven't had that, I can speak to it from a performer point of view, of course, that you have to then fill in the gaps. When you're the only brown person in a environment where the material you're dealing with has to do with brown people, but the makeup artists or hair people and costume people and props and camera and everyone else is not brown, then you're left to answer those questions of, oh, can you wear this accessory? And, oh, is that how you do that? And it's quite literally not the performer's job to answer those questions. It's a consultant's job.
That's a burden, too. That's a lot.
It's unpaid labor. Yeah. is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So I was happy to see that change in what has been my largest role so far for a film project in Make Me a Match, and grateful for how that trickled down into having those questions answered for those folks who are behind the scenes, whether it's costumes or hair or makeup or props or the camera or anything, to have those questions answered by people other than the performers who may not be experts.
Yeah,
like, I'm not an expert. I just have lived experience. And sometimes that makes you an expert. But in this case, I'd like to just do my job. And so I was grateful to see that. And I hope that continues to happen for more departments behind the scenes as we continue to tell diverse stories. I hope that diversity is reflected not only in the cast, but in the storytellers, in the crew, in everyone behind the scenes, because I think that is the real diversity that will have an impact on the storytelling and the impact that this has on audiences.
For sure.
That's a super important message. Listeners, if you're listening, take notes.
Take note, film.
Absolutely.
Also, the movie name
is Make Me a Match.
Better watch it.
Better check it out.
Better check it out.
What channel does Hallmark come on? I remember, like, it was on the Women's Network before.
Yes, it is still the Women's Network.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the distributor for Canada.
That's correct. Amondo. Yeah.
And they tend to re-air content. So keep an eye out. Make Me a Match. We'll be back up there pretty soon.
Who has cable though these days?
Yeah, not me.
We'll find it somehow.
Parents still pay for that. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But we do.
Okay, let's switch it up into your identity and your TikTok videos.
Yeah.
And as we know, that one video that really went viral about coming out as bisexual to your parents. We'll link it so people can see it. But tell us about that experience of dropping that video, the intention behind it, and the feedback that came after.
Yeah, it was a really interesting time. I posted that video about being a bi woman and about dating a man. And I think I posted it simply because it was a new experience for me. Not that I hadn't dated men before, but it was the first time I was dating a man since coming out. as bi to my family. And like, I had gone through this whole journey. You know, 2020 happened. Everyone's like, wow, the whole world is ending.
Yes.
And towards the end of 2020 is when I came out to my family, just because I had had time to reflect and come to this conclusion that I wanted them to know. And I had started dating women after that. I was like, I want to date women. I just want you guys to know I'm bi so that if I'm dating a woman, it's not a massive shock. Mm-hmm. And so I had come out to them and they had had okay reactions. My dad was like immediately supportive. Yeah. I'm like, oh yeah. Like I was like crying in tears. He's silent. I'm like, after I've said I'm bisexual, he's silent. And I was like, and he goes, okay. And I was like, can you say something? He's like, what do you want me to say?
Like, can you react?
Yeah. He was like, he's like, what do you want me to say?
Like, I
was
like, do you understand
what I said? he goes, what? And I was like, can you just tell me that you love me and nothing has changed? And he was like, of course I love you and nothing has changed. Aww. And I was like sobbing, just endless tears. But my mom had a bit of a harder time with it, for sure. And I think that's kind of the core of why I made that TikTok as well. Because she, after finding out that I'm dating a man, was so happy. Just so, so happy. It was like a little disrespectful. I was like, bro, calm down, okay? Just because I am bi and am now dating a man, like, doesn't mean I'm going to marry him, first of all. Please calm down. Yeah. Don't tell my boyfriend I said that. But
he'll hear him.
Yeah, he's going to hear it. But more so, I was just like, she was like, okay, this is it. Like, I didn't think it was going to happen. This girl said she was gay. Like, she was so over the moon excited. And it inspired me to be like, okay, people like my mom need to chill out, okay? Mm. Yes, I'm bi. Yes, I'm dating a man. That is one of the options.
Yeah.
That is simply one of the things that I'm allowed to do is date a man. That I never said I wouldn't. Yeah. I just said I might also date other people.
Yeah.
And the reaction to it was mixed. It was mixed. There was some folks who are like so lovely, so sadly starved for representation that they see a Punjabi woman being like, I'm bi. And they're like, oh, follow, click, like, favorite, share everywhere. Like, and I respect that. I get where that's coming from. Yeah. And I thank them for that sharing and liking of it. And being supportive. There's lots of people being supportive, being like, hell yeah, girl, you live that truth.
Yeah.
I love it.
I mean, we did that.
Exactly.
We shared on our podcast
page.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I love that. That being said, there's also folks who are on the opposite end of the spectrum being like, oh, her poor father is probably crying himself to sleep. And I was like, what do you know about my dad, dude? Like, you don't know my family. And I think there's this assumption that if you're a brown woman taking up space, being unapologetically yourself, just enjoying life, having joy, literally, that you are a failure and a disappointment to your family. It's like our natural state of being is supposed to be in shame, in servitude, in gratitude for existing on this planet. Mm-hmm. And I just don't buy that at all. Mm. Like the shirt says, women don't owe you shit. Yeah. And I don't need to apologize simply for existing as a queer brown woman. I don't need to, and I won't. Yeah. And that is quite triggering for a lot of people, which is more about them than it is about me.
For sure. Yeah.
So I feel grateful that I posted it and that it reached a lot of people, that it connected to a lot of people. A lot of people were happy and excited and laughed along to my silly fun video.
Mm-hmm.
And to the people that were not, to the people that were angry and hateful, I think it's a sad life they're living.
Yeah.
I think it's sad that they want people to shut down and limit themselves and hide away. Like, people literally being like, don't post this. Keep it to yourself.
Mm.
Nobody needs to hear who you like. I was like, okay, clearly some people do, though.
Yeah.
Some people do need to hear who I like. Some people need to hear that I am into women. That sounds weird, but some people need to hear that. Yeah. That's an option. That's my life, and that's allowed. And not enough people are out there as brown women saying that.
No.
So it means a lot. Yeah. And like, I'm so grateful that you guys host this podcast and that you take up this space, because it makes a difference. Your voice has reached me, and I'm sure they're reaching other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. I mean, I love that you touched on that. I mean, I saw the video before even me and Sharon had spoken about it. And I was like, oh, my God, I don't like to tick off boxes mm-hmm. of what I classify myself as, because I think we're all humans and we can do as we please, how we please, whatever we want to do. But I would classify, if I had to go into box, as a bi person mm-hmm. as well. Yeah, like I like everybody, you know.
Absolutely.
But yeah, when I saw it, I was like, oh, my God, this is so awesome to see another queer brown woman online that's like yeah. really representing and saying what's up. I'm like, I'm still not there yet, but like I am here technically.
We totally here, girl. As you we can here.
See, we behind the scenes though.
Yeah. Yeah. We here though.
But it was so nice to see. It was very refreshing. And yeah, I still find it a bit hard sometimes to tell folks because I don't think they're ready. They're not there yet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But mm-hmm. do we need to take up that space? Hell yeah, we do.
Yeah,
absolutely.
As queer folk in general are like marginalized folk. We always need to do that. And as women, and I love your shirt. And that might just be the episode.
I know.
I don't know. I wore it to inspire. Yes. So I'm glad it did.
You inspired.
But I think like as bisexual folks, I think even like just doing research, as we know, there's a lot of bisexual erasure. Like mm-hmm. now that you're dating a man, people might say, oh, like, but you get a pass or mm-hmm. like you don't really get it.
Yeah.
And I've heard these comments and, you know, being in the queer community, I can say I've been guilty of that mm-hmm. before. Mm-hmm. A lot of learning on my own self being in the community. But bisexuals reading up have suffered more from mental health issues, anxiety, depression, because they're getting it from both ends. The heterosexual 100%. World is like either sexualizing it or being like, ew. And then the other community, like the queer community, when in the community, they're like, oh, but you're going to leave me. And I've seen this in both ends. Mm-hmm. So I would love to hear, like, what can we do better to support bisexual folks? Because it is, as the stats are showing, research is saying that bisexual folks suffer more, twice as likely than lesbian and queer people in the community. So clearly we're not doing a good job. Because we're thinking, oh, it's easier, but studies are showing, no, it's not. So, like, what can we do better as a community?
It's a tricky game, I won't yeah. lie. Because even now, as a woman who is in a, like, I consider my relationship to be a queer relationship because I am queer.
Yeah.
It's that simple. That being said, to the world, it's like a hetero-passing yeah. relationship. And in some ways, I can't deny that socially and culturally, that does make my life easier. Mm-hmm. It does. Mm-hmm. Because that is what is accepted in the culture, is me being in this hetero-passing relationship. It makes it easier on everybody, including my mom, which is why she's yeah. so happy about it. But it also leaves you with a type of duplicitous feeling inside, where you as a bisexual person know that passing as a straight person is not your truth. Yeah, it's not yeah. who you are. And especially for most of us who, because of our heteronormative society, have lived that way mm-hmm. at some point or another, or assumed to be yep. straight for most of our lives until we said otherwise,
yep.
it can be kind of re-traumatizing to be put back in a closet, even though you're mm-hmm. fighting your way out, to be like, I'm not, though, not straight, just saying. And I joke about this all the time. I'm like, I'm constantly coming out to my family. Like, yeah. I keep reminding my mom I'm gay, like, every so often. Like, she'll be, like, talking about marriage and this person marrying that person, or my wedding to my boyfriend, which is fine.
Yeah.
I like him a lot. Yeah. Even love him a little. And I don't find the idea of marriage or marrying a man scary. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I can do.
Yeah.
But I often just throw in, like, by the way, you remember I still like girls. I like throw that in there just as a fun bit. Mm-hmm. But also because I think a lot of us have to keep coming out to our families so that they don't ignore or dismiss yes. our identities. And I think as a bisexual person, that just happens a whole lot.
Yes.
Because many people consider it like a weird halfway point,
mm.
which it's not, just a whole complete identity and a way of living. Like you said, I feel similarly. I'm not necessarily putting myself in the bisexual box. I just think that the people I'm attracted to is not because of their genitalia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
just like, if I'm attracted to someone, what they have in their pants just doesn't matter that much. And yeah. and that's it. It's mm. not that complicated. When you're a bisexual, especially as a woman, I think you're assumed straight.
Yep.
This is the stereotype, right? And if you mm. are a bisexual man, you're assumed gay.
Yeah.
And both understandings are patriarchal
mm.
and focused on the belief that you must want to be with a man.
Yeah, totally. That's like in my experience as well. And like dating, you know, if you tell, you know, a woman, oh, hey, like I'm bi, they're like, oh, you're going to leave me for a guy.
Is that what I said?
I like you though.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is real and we've heard it. I don't know about the community now, but I think we definitely need to have a lot more learning.
A lot more learning to do.
It's still, I feel like, a very prevalent assumption.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, even I'm not sure in your experience as well, like if you're like telling a guy that you're dating, they're like, ooh, exciting. Yeah. And I'm like, shut the front door.
Did I tell you that I'm having a threesome with you? No.
That's exactly their mind. I didn't say that.
Boom, it goes right there. And I completely agree. Yeah. The assumptions that you're promiscuous, that you're experimental, that you're freaky, that you're blah, blah, blah. And it's like none of those things have anything to do with sexuality. They can exist separately.
100%.
Very straight people can be very freaky, guys.
Yeah.
Hello. Did you watch 50 Shades of Grey? Yeah. I didn't. But I think it's that. Yeah, it's that belief, right? That you, it just means that you want to, again, have sex with a lot of people.
Yeah, it's so messed up. It's like you want to have your cake and eat it too. It's like it has nothing to do with any of that kind of stuff. So like people get their mind out of the gutters. Like, dude, we're just human. We like who we like, and it's that. And when you're with somebody, you're with somebody. It's just like any other relationship.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And quite like what I was saying earlier, too. It's like the hyperfixation on sex when it comes to queer relationships that, oh, if you are a bi person, it's all about who you want to sleep with.
Mm. Yeah.
Who said that? Why are you focused on that? It's because view queer people as nothing more than who they want to sleep with. And that is so limiting. That is so dehumanizing to not view a person's relationships as anything more than their sexual contact with other people. And with bi people especially, because folks have this view of like, oh, you go both ways means you must be swinging both ways all the time. It's like, you know, maybe some people, and that's fine too, as long as everyone's consenting. But if you see queer folks, bi folks, or whoever as more than just who they are sleeping with at that time, then you can easily see how romance and relationships and even sex is not that limited. It's not that limiting of anyone's freedom. And I think we can all benefit from being a little bit less obsessed with each other's sex lives. Gonna put that out there, especially as brown folks. Oh my God, calm down. Brown people need to chill out when it comes to sexuality. And I know it's deeply entrenched, has a lot to do with British colonialism, but I still think that our community today needs to take a freaking chill pill when it comes to sex. And I think it only gets further demonized when it comes to queer relationships.
Because
it becomes even less focused on the people and even more focused on the act. Which is dehumanizing and sad.
But I think it's important what you said, like, for all our listeners to understand and to hopefully take from this episode, like, if they know bisexual people in their lives, to, like you said, not focus on only the act or like that, you know, they're promiscuous or all these, you know, negative stereotypes or whatever it may be, to really understand what it means to be bisexual. And like, it's not only about the act, but also recognizing like we need to be more accepting. Even in the queer community, we can be very judgmental. So we can only expect we start from ourselves and then move out to understand. We have to be more open-minded and understand what it means to be bisexual. Because, yeah, as an educator, like, I was starting a diversity club and then I was doing more research. I was like, oh, my God, I had no idea that bisexuals, like, suffer the most in terms of mental health. That was quite surprising for me. Because, like, in my mind, from my experience in the queer community, it's very like, oh, bisexuals have a pass. But we know that's
must
not
have it
true.
Easy, right?
It's not true.
It's not. No. It's not.
It's harmful, actually, to have that
thinking. And to perpetuate that, too, right? To perpetuate the belief that by having more options, you simply have it easy. Yeah. Which, like, no sometimes way. Having more options means you have lesser options, actually. Like, not everybody that is in your options wants you as an option.
And it's very internal. Like,
Totally. Yeah. And it's the internalized biphobia and, like, you know, homophobia as well can be really, really damaging, as we know, like, amongst queer folks, internalized or amongst any oppressed minority group. Having that oppression internalized can be so much worse than yes. some of the stuff that you deal with externally. And I find, for me still, because I've only been out really for like 2 years or something, and so much of that time I've spent being in a relationship with a man, that I still have to do the work to really unpack that and how it is affecting my mental health, or, you know, how the folks that are sometimes, because my partner is a Punjabi man who, like, born and raised in Surrey, and not what I expected, by the way, when I came out to my family as bisexual, is to bring home a Punjabi guy who grew up like 5 minutes away from me. Insane. But with him too, it's like there's folks in his circle that he grew up with who still talk as if they are in high school. Like, these are people are like 30 yeah. years old yeah. Yeah. and they are like throwing out the same bullshit slurs and the same yeah. attitudes that I remember hearing in like grade 9 high yes. school in my socials class, with these boys yapping in Punjabi thinking I can't understand them. It's the same shit. And even now, it's like I have to take the steps to recognize, okay, what spaces are safe for me?
Yes.
Yeah.
What people are safe for me? Because it's not everyone.
No.
And it's not all spaces.
Yeah.
And it takes time to also, you know, take up that space to be like, I am not comfortable here. These attitudes, these people, these words are not safe for me. They're not comfortable for me. And I will do what I need to do to take up the space and distance myself. Because I think a lot of brown women, it's so sad, and it's, I think, a lived experience for a lot of us, are used to staying quiet about things that bother us for the greater good of keeping the peace or not making a scene or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. No, I get called like outspoken because I speak up. And yeah. I'm like, I just come to the point, I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm just like, whatever. Like, I'm going to say what I'm going to say when I want to say it. I mean, in all due respect to certain folks, but people that are like coming at me with BS, no, I'm going to put you in your place. Because if I don't take up the space right now, you're going to continue to be the silly person that you are.
Absolutely.
You got to stop people in their tracks. Our first season opener with Belt Edge, we had, you know, he's either you embrace education or you embrace hate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's how I see it as.
Absolutely. And I think you do them a disservice too by staying quiet. And, you know, in some cases I get it. I understand protecting your own peace. I understand distancing yourself for safety or because you've tried so many times. Like, I still have cousins to this day that try to get a rise out of me by saying the N-word or whatever. Like, and I'll be like, okay, I'm just not engaging. Like, I've tried to convince you enough times. And if that's where you stand, I'm just not going to talk to you. And you can go ahead and deal with that, the lack of my presence. but I think it is that. It's, you know, we have become accustomed, a lot of us, and it's not our freaking jobs to, like, educate every man, child on the planet. It is too much work for any one person to do. But I do think that taking up space, even in those moments, even when they seem small, even when they seem exhausting, whenever it is safe for us to do so, taking up that space to stand in the truth of what we feel and what we think, and letting people know that, like, your bigotry and hatred isn't okay. It's actually not great. It's actually terrible, and you're a loser. I think that's important. I think it's important for our generation to not turn into the same stuff we've been seeing for generation after generation after generation. We have uncles in the making amongst us right now.
100%. We got to stop that stuff.
And it's important.
It is important.
I feel like it is. Like, there's a lot of, like, brown women spaces, as you see online, like, brown women, like, book clubs, brown women circles. And, like, even at work the other day, we had such a powerful conversation about, like, casteism and, like, patriarchy in our community. And, like, I was like, wow, like, this is so healing. And I think, like, I never was aware of any of this stuff. We could say maybe like 5-10 years ago that, like, we can say, hey, you know, that's not okay.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can't really tell me how to live my life. Like, we weren't really taught this unless you have really amazing moms who have been. I mean, if you don't see that in your family, I think now you can go online and you can see these powerful women who are doing it, like yourself.
Oh, thanks.
Who are here making, like, videos like how you have, being an acting role, that who are stepping out of the norm, which maybe if we didn't see in our own family, we get to see out in the community. I think that's why, like, having you today is so powerful in many ways, not just for bisexuality, but also following your passion and being such a loud, proud woman who wants to take up space. Because, it like you said, it is hard in some families. Like, I'm not as loud and vocal in my own family, but
I think also, like you said, safety is a thing.
So and safety is a huge thing.
Safety is a huge
and
thing.
And I want to say this for all the listeners and for you guys, too. I think I recognize that I come from a very privileged place. Mm. My family has given me a wealth of confidence and empathy and understanding that I think most brown women sadly do not get. Mm. And it becomes their own journey to try and fight for that confidence, fight for that space. And I know it's a harder journey than the one I've had because they're starting off at a different place. And I just want to say to anybody listening, whether you're a brown woman or not, I hope that you can find the safety to take up that space, whether it's within your home or outside of it. I hope that you are one day safe enough to take up the space to be authentically yourself, because I think that's where your journey starts of living life in a way that is soul fulfilling, as well as just continuing. You know, living is different from existing on this planet. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of women, especially brown women, are born and raised in an attitude of being subservient, not just like literally, like cooking and cleaning and all that stuff, which of course we all see and are aware of, but also mentally and like spiritually being tied to the men in our lives, especially, but also just like generations above us, of being tied to the beliefs of the people around us. Yeah. Women in our culture especially carry the burden of what people think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it affects them the most. The people who die the social death are not the men. Mm-hmm. It's the women. So I understand where the fear and all of that comes from, because the people who experience the ostracization are not the men.
Yeah.
You know, the alcoholic dad who beats his wife and his kids is still welcome at the party.
Yep.
You know, yep. But his wife, if she chooses to leave him, may not be.
Yeah.
And that's insane, but it's a part of our culture. I don't want to deny that woman's taking up of space led to that ostracization. Mm-hmm. You know, this is fictional, but it's also not. I'm sure you guys know real people that happened to.
Everybody knows somebody.
You know, exactly.
Invite them.
Invite them to your house.
Yeah.
Make them a part of your community. Yeah. You know, excluding women for breaking out of these extremely limited roles of how they can exist and how they can be, what makes them a member of good society, is what is breaking down the actual values of our culture. It's what's limiting us and dividing us further. And I hope that through this podcast and through other efforts that it changes.
We do too. So whoever's listening, listen up, listen well, and let's make change.
Yeah.
And on that note, I think we're going to wrap up. Because we've said what we've said. Because
women it's all don't been know said.
Women don't know you shit.
I know that's right.
So thank you so much, Rahat, for being on the Share Vancouver podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Three,
baby.
Season 3.
Yeah, episode 3.
So what we'll do is just, what are your handles? Where can people reach you? Give you a shout, collab, et cetera. Throw it at us.
Please. You can find me on Instagram and used to be Twitter. I just deleted it. So on Threads as Rahat Sani, at Rahat Sani. You can still follow me on TikTok at Rahati. I don't post that much anymore. And you can keep up with me online on those platforms. You can check out www.rahatsani.com. If you want to collaborate with me, have me MC your party or have my mom sing at it. Whatever you want. And I hope that if you're listening to this, that you continue to take up space and live in your truth.
Love it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. On three, we'll say bye. 1, 2, 3.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Share Vancouver podcast with Sharon and Neri. Brought to you by Share Vancouver and generously sponsored by 100 Gay Men for a Cause and Envision Financial. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the guests only and do not necessarily reflect the views, policy, or position of Share Vancouver. Remember to like, share, and leave a review. And follow us on Instagram at ShareVan Podcast. Thanks for listening.